as some recommendations for addressing that. I think we'll start right off with Minnesota Parent Teacher Association. We have Mari Porkanowski, who's here, and Karen Furlack. Good morning. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. My name is Mari Pokanowski, and I'm one of two that are representing the Minnesota PTA. I'm also a former teacher and also a parent of seven children aging in the age of 11 to the age of 24.
I'm Karen Furlack. I've been with Minnesota PTA at the state level for quite a few years now. I am the mother of five and the grandmother of nine. And I thank you for inviting us. Before we begin, I do have some literature that I would like the committee to have. These are the newly revised national standards for family school partnerships from the National PTA. I also have in Spanish and English 100 ways to help your child succeed in school and others that you might find helpful. I would like to point out that the family standards were co-written this year by Ann Henderson from the Annenberg Institute on School Reform in Washington, D.C., and Karen Mapp, who is the head of the Department of Education at Harvard. And it is they have written a book entitled Beyond the Bake Sale. And any of you that have an opportunity to get a copy, it's probably one of the most fabulous things that's been written for teachers, administrators, and parents on parent involvement in schools for the success of all children.
Now, one of our goals to discuss here when it comes to the achievement gap is talking about children and children who thrive. Children who thrive are children who are fed and are healthy. They feel safe and they feel wanted. And also that they are in an environment in which their uniquenesses are understood and are supported and encouraged. In the achievement gap, while I was researching this for today, I went back to some of my educational classes when I took preparing myself to be a teacher. What I'm as surprised is that this issue is we are continuing to discuss it, that many of those issues that they feel very strongly would have made a difference, we have yet to fully implement those things. So as a former teacher and as a parent, that saddens me greatly. One area, and especially why we're here as the PTA, is the whole issue of closing the achievement gap, is recognizing the role of parent involvement. Parent involvement means recognizing that participation of parents in every facet of the education and the development of children from birth to adulthood is needed for success. Now, please remember, this does not imply that parents are not involved. It means that parents need who are involved in their children's lives, because we all know, as many of us as parents, is that we want to be involved and make whatever is best for our children come to be. So what it means is that we as state and school and administrators and teachers, that we open the doors and make sure that door is open for that parent can do all that they can do that we all know as parents we want to do. Parents' involvement takes many forms, including parents as first educators, as decision makers about children's education, their health and well-being, as well as advocates for children's success. It recognizes that parents are the primary influence in their children's lives. This is more than just a report card or midterm report, nor a notice when a child has an infraction or suspension. It means that when that teacher sees that that child is struggling immediately upon that first quarter, that those first days, that parents are notified. It does not mean that at midterm that is sufficient notification to parents that that child is struggling. Nor does it mean that when a child is finally to the point of receiving an infraction or a suspension that the parent is notified. Rather, when those first moments problems are surfacing that parents, that teachers, administrations partner with that parent in order to make sure that those issues are dealt with immediately. It is, again, a partnership between teachers, administration, and parent. We know that this takes place in socioeconomic, cultural, learning styles, and is what is happening in each child's life. Now, there is 30 years of documentation to student achievement, and recognize that in these 30 years of study, that parent involvement is critical to the success of our children. There are 60 national groups that endorse just this.
One of the issues that I'm sure all cities, whether they be rural today in Minnesota or inner city, is the cultural diversity that could be not causing but hampering a child's success. And perhaps PTA, as well as the education institutions, all have to look at this. It is extremely important for a school to be welcoming. One of the things I found last year as I toured the state of Minnesota, discussing PTA and our welcoming attitudes and communities, was with so many of our immigrants that are coming to this country right now that particularly don't speak the language. Education in the lands that they came from was such an extreme honor and such a privilege that they tend to stand a little in awe of our schools. And they think it's just wonderful to be able to put their child on a bus and send them to a school free of charge. I think along with PACER received the PERC grant, the Parent Involvement Grant, this year. And they do an outstanding job with going out into communities and providing information for parents of all cultures, including our own in Minnesota, who might be lagging behind, to welcome them into the school. And PTA wants to be there to help with that as well, and we do. But I think it is something that we all need to address, perhaps even at the state level, that schools need to be welcoming. And that is one of the only ways that we can succeed in educating and getting a parent involvement cooperation going. Last year, PTA brought forward, with the help of Representative Norton and Senator Robes, a parent involvement bill. It succeeded through committee, got in the omnibus bill, and then got stalled a little bit. And we're not going to give up on it, because parent involvement isn't bake sales and carnivals. Parent involvement is education. But I've done the carnivals and the bake sales, but it all comes together. And so I think we do have to work on all of our cultures coming together for the success of the state. That's what it's about. My husband sits on the P16 committee, and there's a lot of discussion on rigor right now. There's a lot of discussion on the math standards that seem to be preoccupying P16. I say preoccupying only because preschool through K isn't getting a lot of attention by that committee. K through 16 is getting a lot of... The math standards that are now being recommended should be studied very carefully in the amount of rigor, because it could increase the gap if these standards are clearly put in place without additional resources to bring students that are suffering from an achievement gap up to par. I only bring that up because I live with it at home constantly from my husband, who sits on that committee, and it is a deep concern of his. I would like you all to read the document that we handed out. It is a national document that we have introduced all over the country, and National PTA is very, very concerned about parent involvement at this point in our efforts.
Talking about the different cultures, that one of the issues in which there is the achievement gap is to what is often emphasized in education is, what is your objective? For example, if you're in a math class, your objective is to teach them math. If your objective is in social study, it is, of course, to teach them social studies. Of course, we incorporate many other of the genres into that. However, when you have a student who is not, their native language is not English, oftentimes we then assume, or we then just use English to try to, in order to teach the social studies, the math. Studies have been done that if those subject matters are taught in their first language, their success is far higher than if it is just taught in the English language. There are many methods that have been emphasized, and we seem to forget about them. We also forget about that today we have more, our teachers are more trained than they have ever been in history. Unfortunately, though, when teachers are so trained, you know, but when there is not materials in the classroom, when there are 36 students in the classroom, the success rate is not going to happen to the extent in which we want it to.
I know that we aren't going to succeed at lowering the class sizes for a very, very long time. Many times I have heard over the course of the last my many years being involved with education. I am not a teacher, by the way. I pulled out of education because I realized I couldn't do it and went into a different field. But my husband did stay. He's a retired 35-year high school teacher. And I think many times I have heard our students in public schools compared to private school students and charter school students that have a lower class size. And I have to say that because I went to 9 years of parochial school and I sat through classes of 58 kids in a class, and I was blessed, fortunately, with no learning disabilities that are evident anyhow, I handled it quite well. And larger class sizes, we've all wished for that class of 15 students. And many private schools are blessed with 15 to 20 students in a class. I'm sure any teacher would feel it a true reward to only have 15 or 20 students in a class. And actually, as a parent, I would have loved to have had my kids in a class of 15 to 20 students. And to compare the achievement of kids that are in classes of 15 to 20 students with those in 35 to 40, I think is wrong on the part of our education institutions and our legislature. I think we do have to find another way of funding our schools. The way we have right now is ineffective. I wonder what our communities would be like if they couldn't just raise taxes at will and had to go and have a referendum for more street cleaning equipment or to fix the local water system. I'm not advocating that, but I do think education seriously has to look at its funding means. I think we're done.
I think we are. Again, thank you very much for inviting us to participate in this morning. Thank you.
Well, I'm looking at the new brochure, and this is the first time I've had a chance to see it, too. But on page 3 in the inside, there are 6 standards. And I'm used to looking at these in another form, but I think they're very similar to what National PTA has been dealing with in terms of their recommendations on how to close the achievement gap. And the bottom line there is parent involvement increases student achievement. And their main thrust is saying when parents are involved, the achievement gap gets closed. And you talked a little bit about the welcoming atmosphere in school communities. Can you just run us through for the record the other 5 standards and maybe a little bit about what each of them are? I know that there are resources that PTA has specific to each of the standards, because it's pretty easy for people to come in and say, oh, well, engage your parents or provide a welcoming environment. And, you know, how do you actually do that? Or so it seems to me PTA has in other materials beyond this resources that tell you exactly what to do in standard 1 through 6. But could you just briefly continue on with what standard 2 is, 3, 4, 5, and 6?
Well, first of all, Senator Robes, I think we should say we are not advocating the feared helicopter parent. Many times people misinterpret that with PTA's parent involvement as saying we want every parent there as well. We don't have room in the building for the kids we've got there. We don't need one or two parents there for every child as well. But what we are advocating is the welcoming of all cultures to the school. And this is done through family nights. As I toured around St. Paul, Minneapolis last year in some of our bilingual schools, they have a variety of activities they use to bring parents together that are very effective. And usually it's through food, which is a really nice thing, or through music programs, which is also a very nice thing. The second standard is to communicate effectively. Families and school staff engage in regular two-way and meaningful communication about student learning. I think Mari spoke to it earlier in saying don't wait until the end of the quarter. As a parent and even as a grandparent who is very active with my grandchildren, I like to know where right away they have a problem. And or they have a success. It's kind of nice to share the successes, too, and not just the problems. And go ahead.
I think one tool that the National PTA, Minnesota PTA, provides for their parents, their communities, is an effective way to build coalitions with their school, you know, their administration, their school board, and with groups within the community, how best that we all together can have a voice in what is best for our children. Because oftentimes a parent's perspective may be somewhat different than an administrative perspective, especially, you know, when there are some cultural, you know, differences at hand. It means that that all are invited to the table and all have an equal voice.
I think the third standard I spoke to just a few minutes ago is supporting student success. And I think that's critical, and I don't think there's a person in this room that would disagree with that. It is important to celebrate not only the success of our students, but of our schools, and sometimes when we're working to make them better, sometimes it makes them sound like they're not so good. And we do know in Minnesota that we have great successes with our schools through our testing, through the NCLB, the NAEP tests, and the ACT tests. We know we're doing a good job. It's just that in Minnesota, I think we're never happy. We just want it to be better all the time, which is a really good thing for this country, I think. Number 4 is speaking up for every child. Whether you're PTA, PTO, building advisory committees, it's important that when we speak, we don't just speak about a certain group of children, that we speak for all children, because we live here in a community together, a large state and national community, and many people refer to our global community, and it is very, very important that we speak for every child. PTA speaks for every child with one voice, and that's what we'd like to promote throughout the state.
Sharing powers, families and school staff, equal partners in the decision that affects children, families, and together, inform, influence, create policies, practices, and programs, i.e. Title I. There is, within Title I, there needs to be, and I don't know if I have the right, correct term, but there needs to be a parent council within each school district. And this is a representation of the diversity within your school. PTI, one of the things that PTA does is helps informs that is a requirement so parents know that they can have that voice.
There's a number of schools that I visited this past year that do have Title I services, and these parents did not know what their parent involvement policy was. I'm not sure who wrote the policy, when it was written, but as we go around the state now, we do inform parents that are from Title I schools, and 90% of our state do have Title I services, that they should know what the policy is, they should be involved in the policy, and they perhaps should look at that policy every year.
I think it also, you know, when one is working on an IEP, the importance of parents to realize that they can be a participant in that meeting. I myself have a child who is dyslexic and also has Tourette syndrome, so I've sat in many an IEP meeting, and the number of parents of children that didn't or who did have also special needs that didn't realize that they can be a partner in helping that child succeed in formulating that IEP. Because oftentimes what is happening in the home, what works well, you know, what you're seeing as a parent and the goals of you as that parent needs to be the same goals within the child. My child, learning or Tourette syndrome, the child, Joseph, my son, understanding cause and effect, i.e. handing in homework. You know, there needed to be consistency in learning about cause and effect, about responsibility of timelines, was something that needed to be implemented at home, as well as the school, i.e. partnership, in helping him develop those skills that did not come to him naturally because of his Tourette syndrome, i.e. another example of sharing power and finding success for our children.
And the sixth standard is collaborating with community. I think many of us do know that schools aren't just about schools and parents. They're about a whole community, whether it be a state or a city. One thing that was very evident when I went out to very small towns that have K-12 programs, because I was never raised in a small town, I was always raised in suburbs, and I live in suburbs now, is the sense of community that the school is the center of everything in some of those very, very small towns. And I applaud that. I think it's very admirable, and I wish we could get back to that in some of our city schools. But I think we do, and I think we need more active participation of our businesses, and all of our communities, our Chamber of Commerce. You know, we can't do it alone. And there is one politician running for office now that says it takes a village to raise a child. And that's very, very true. And we all help. I help my neighbor kids with things now that my children are raised. And it takes grandparents. It takes anybody that really, truly cares about a child to be involved. And that is our business community, our legislature. Collaborating with the community is a very good thing for schools to do.
As a member of a school district, a small school district this morning was 2.5 hours away. Usually it's 1 hour and 10 minutes away. We were a national school of excellence about 11, 12 years ago. Due to budget cuts, we now are struggling. For example, at the point that we were a national school of excellence, we had 3 languages of 4 years each. Now we have 1 language of 2 years, and that's over 35 kids to a classroom. The whole, you know, one aspect of child success is after-school programs. However, we cannot support after-school programs anymore because of, again, the lack of funding for our schools. So it is critical that we are collaborating with our community, i.e. businesses, parent groups, you know, helping raise the money, helping do the volunteer coaching in order for us to have the after-school math programs, the plays, the sports. And so that is another example of why collaborating with your community is critical, especially in this day and age where funding is so scarce.
Well, thank you much for coming today. It's going to be very interesting for us to take a look at these 6 standards as we move forward and try to come up with a plan for Minnesota. But I think your point, you know, beyond the bake sale, that whole concept is, you know, we used to look at parents as, you know, just doing bake sales, trying to raise money for the extras in schools, like whether it was the artist in residence programs or art opportunities or field trips. and more we're relying on parents to fundraise for basics in schools. But PTA encourages us to think of them not only as fundraisers, but as equal partners in their children's decision-making and, more broadly, all children's best interests by including them on policy committees and in the classroom and at board levels and district meetings, because it is all about parent involvement in helping to close the achievement gap. Okay. Comments from the committee or questions? Senator Salzman.
This is a great hearing, and it's great to hear from parents, Madam Chair, and you've certainly been a leader in that respect, so thank you. A question. In looking at the achievement gap, we've heard repeatedly that parents can be involved in many different ways, and I wonder if you could discuss briefly the difference between empowering parents and holding parents responsible for their role in a child's education. I went and listened to a group of teachers who are running charter schools in the Milwaukee area, and these are schools that are chartered by the district. And the teachers talked about during the weeks when they were off, they have a year-round calendar, they went out and they met with the families in their home environment. And they were very clear with them about your responsibility is your child needs to be at school on time and be a partner with us. But it wasn't sort of this, we hope you'll be involved, we hope you'll come with us. It was pretty clear, you are part of the team, and here's your responsibility. I know that when Teach for America is screening their applicants, I happen to see some of their reading materials, and one of the pieces was about parental involvement, and that if we look at parent involvement as just, did they come to literacy night? Did they come? Did they, you know, did they come to us? We're not really acknowledging that some parents are working two jobs, and the most important thing they can do is make sure their child's getting their homework done, is at school on time. I mean, that we should never underestimate that important role. So can you talk a little bit about empowerment versus responsibility? Because we have to be a team, but we have to be, I think, very firm that if we're making these investments in these programs, how do we truly make sure that parents are there with us? Thank you.
Senator Salzman, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I do think There's only so much that PTA can do as an organization, but I do think in the book Beyond the Bake Sale, it addresses those home visits. I was very pleased, but very surprised to see them there. I do believe in the olden days in the little schoolhouse, the teacher had such a minimal salary that she literally visited every family, he or she, so that they had a meal at night. But it was probably overall a really, really good thing, because there is a parent responsibility as far as getting your child to school. And I think parent groups need to work with their faculty on that. And the discussion has to be made. I think that perhaps charter schools and private schools are a little bit more successful in that kind of a message. Public schools are held to a different, not necessarily standard, but a different communication system. And I think we can all improve that as parents. One thing that was brought up to me that was very interesting when we went to the bilingual school in St. Paul, the Holmcroft School, and we were talking about the word volunteer. And we in PTA and the schools use the word volunteer pretty liberally. And it was pointed out to us that in the Hispanic Latino culture language, that there is no word for volunteer. They understand help. And one of the things we've advised the PERC committee, PTA sits on the PERC committee for PACER, to look at the language we use when asking for volunteers. In fact, they had quite a bit of they used the word volunteer quite a bit in some of their literature. We asked them to remove it and put the word, because even in the Somali culture, the word volunteer, I see Senator Torres Reyes shaking her head. Actually, the Somali culture even told me that that the word volunteer means work for free. And it has a little different connotation, which is the truth, but has a little bit different connotation. So we did study, you know, and I think, but I realize what you're saying. And as a parent group, I think it's something that a conversation that can be had with faculty and administration, but under the parent involvement piece, they have to also, we have to both be open on each side to that conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a good one to have, though.
If I could answer that also, is we have to make sure that we're communicating clearly. You know, we just assume that when we send out that flyer at the beginning of the school year, that all parents sat down and were able to read it and understood it completely, you know, that you need to be responsible to make sure that your kids are participating fully in school. Well, you know, we need to make sure that there are no language barriers. We need to make sure that they're that parent understand that, have we fully communicated what does that mean? That, you know what, will you make sure that your children are prepared to come to school in the morning? Throwing that out will mean many different things. What that means is that your child has their shoes in their backpack, that they have their spelling words completed in the backpack, that et cetera, et cetera. That you need to articulate your want clearly with parents. Also, we have to understand, and this is something that, I remember from one of my educational classes, and something that I implemented throughout my teaching career, was that we have to understand maybe who some of these parents are. Some of these parents that are most not likely to show up to, especially in, you know, in the white culture, many of those parents that will not show up oftentimes had horrible high school school experiences themselves. For them to walk into a high school or to call a teacher is, they have such a negative experience themselves that they bring to the table, to their experience, that what is the point? Why should I? My child is failing. They're going to tell me my child is failing. What's the point of me calling? It is that whole emotional history that they have that they bring to the table, and oftentimes that is one of the main reasons why parents do not come and participate in this effort. We as educators have to recognize that and help take them by the hand and help them welcome them back into the conversation to help their child succeed. Nick Miller was my principal when I taught at Buffalo High School. I believe he was the national principal of the year. And Nick Miller emphasized over and over again that it's our responsibility to communicate with the teacher, or to the parent, excuse me, at all times. The goods, the bads, the mediums, but we need to be constantly communicating with that parent. Nick Miller's high school had limited behavioral problems, had academic success because of that connection that we made, that he encouraged and forced with his teachers to have that happen. I also had another teaching experience in Hutchinson High School, just to give you the idea of how do we get kids all to participate. This was a class of 36, and this was grouping. You know, I was a former English teacher, and this was third level, okay, third level of grouping. First was honors, second were the next. Fourth was learning disabilities. Third was the rest of the kids, should we say. Out of that 36, only 5 of them were girls. In that class, there were students who left. School started, class started at 7 o'clock in the morning. At 3:30 at the end of their day, they were at work, working until midnight, because many of them were supplementing their family income or paying for their own survival, their own rent, their own food. Now, for me to have expected these students who were leaving and going directly to work to go home and do 2 hours of homework would have encouraged failure for these students. These students were here every single day. They wanted an education, but we had to be realistic and understanding and help them succeed in this process. These parents who were struggling, you know, and their child supplementing their income, what do we say to them? What do we say to them about their responsibility? At this point, it was a survival mode for these parents and for these families. So again, we need to understand where all these parents are coming from, and we need to realistically understand it and implement our policies around it.
Thank you. Anything else? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming this morning. Excuse me, and I think we all appreciate the work that you do and have done, and we're very interested in your presentation. And I particularly take your point about the necessity of having strong parental involvement in education. I think there is broad agreement that that is a key. It may not be sufficient to make sure or to make progress against the gaps in achievement, but I think it is a necessary component that we have strong parental involvement and engagement in education. And as I'm looking at your material and hearing your presentation, I'm wondering, does that mean, would you then support the school choice options that are available to parents and expanding those to make sure that parents can send their children to any school that they wish, public, private, charter, homeschool, without the impediment of resources getting in the way of that decision? Or does your organization support that robust vision of school choice that gives the decision-making power to families and parents to decide which schools are right for their children?
Well, if you're speaking of vouchers, no. National PTA does not support vouchers. And I have spoken here, testified many times against vouchers in this state. I think it's always wonderful when a parent chooses a school for their child. It shows that they're extremely involved with their child. So no matter what school that child goes to, they're probably going to be pretty successful because mom and dad are already on board. If the voucher system did not take money away from public schools, might be something to talk about, but it doesn't work that way. And the more we harm our public schools, if we took all those dreams of vouchers and invested them in our public schools right now, we maybe wouldn't have a few of the problems we have. But to strip more money out of the public school system at this time, I just don't think we can have a conversation. We have an open school policy in this, an open enrollment policy in this state. And so if you don't, my son-in-law teaches at Wayzata High School. There are a number of students that come in from Minneapolis to Wayzata High School. Their parents get them there because they choose to get them there. And Wayzata has its own needs, even though it passes all its levies. My grandchildren are sitting in elementary school with 39 kids in a class after third grade. So just because it's an elite suburb doesn't mean it has lower class size. I think Minnesota, we've done a fine job of leading the nation with a lot of our open and choice policies. But I will say this because I've had this conversation with Congresswoman Betty McCollum. Until private charter homeschools agree to take the same tests that public schools take, I don't think we can have this conversation because, you see, a private school isn't tested in the same manner. The requirements aren't the same. I know a number of administrators that say, yes, that private school is wonderful, except that when they have special needs, they march their children down to our public school for those courses and are tested at those public schools. So I think, Senator Hand, with all due respect, I know you are a proponent of vouchers. I think this is a very large conversation for this time and place.
I'd also like to, when Senator Saltzman made the comment about parent responsibility, I think this is a prime example of parent responsibility. If the school is not functioning where it needs to be functioning, this is where parent responsibility of investing in their community, investing in their school to make it what they want it to be. Also, I'm rural. school choice. I'm rural. what is my school choice? Where, you know, for me to travel, I grew up in Red Lake Falls. For me to go to the next school for school choice, it would be over 20 miles to get to the next school. Within my school district, Odessa-Cokato, there are several school districts, but however, they're Glencoe-Silver Lake. We all know about the financial situation of Glencoe-Silver Lake, Atwater Grove City, school choice. The other is that it's an up, you know, if we view this as a parent's choice. However, at the ages of my particular children, and our levy almost failed again, and we've been without a levy now, so we're down to the bare minimum, and we were going to be cutting more money consistently, you know, year after year. My children, extracurricular activities, be them speech or music or sports, my children would have been punished for a year because of the new rules of that you cannot go into a school district without, you cannot move to another school district without having to sit on the bench or sit out for an entire year. So, and we, you know, we live on the family farm, four-generation farm. We couldn't. So there are a lot of wonderful concepts. However, when implementing them, unfortunately, as far as providing choice to parents, many of these choices, you know, to many of us, are not achievable.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up, and I appreciate your comments. And you're right, I have been a proponent of vouchers, and I had a bill that would apply to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that bill did, in fact, leave money in the public schools, even though the students had left. But my question really wasn't about that. It was more about the general principle, because I support expanding voucher opportunities. I support the open enrollment. I support PSEO. I support the online learning, homeschool, all those things. To me, it's more a question of, is the principle of parent involvement strong enough to say that if parents want to choose, should we not find a way to overcome whatever obstacles we can conceive of to enable them to make a choice? And if that obstacle is purely financial, should we not find a way to help with that as well? And so it's not, I understand that you may not appreciate a voucher as a solution. I don't think it is a panacea. I think it is one of the number of things that could be done. But I'm more interested in just the principle of reinforcing the role of parents by saying in a very clear and strong way to all families that you are in the decision-making position, and we will support the decisions that you make regardless of where you choose to go. And just so in a general way, that was my question, and maybe if you want to respond to that rather than a particular idea, or there are certainly obstacles in any idea that we can conceive of. But.
Well, I will tell you, I found it very interesting, Senator Hand, when I visited the bilingual school in St. Paul, Holmcroft. I asked a number of the parents that were there. Some went to that school, some went to other schools. I was actually at a community center. And I asked what was one of their biggest concerns, and getting to school safely was a huge concern of these parents. And I said, but you live in this community. You're sending your children away from this school to another school. Obviously, there's something you like about that school. And they said, we like the fact that our children are put on a bus and bus there. So that's why we send our children to a particular, we pick another school, because when we leave for work in the morning, we don't want to have to worry about our child arriving at school walking. And you know, I had to stop and think, now, is this a school choice issue or a safety issue? And it was a safety issue to a lot of these people. Now, their children, they were making fine choices. But the one lady said her children walked to school and they were two blocks away. She worried about them, but that they didn't have anybody to walk with, because all of the other children, there were four buses that came into that neighborhood to take children to other schools. This is all fine, but if it's a safety issue, I think there's something very valuable in a community neighborhood school. I went to one, and even though it was a private school for 9 years, I walked, and I felt safe. And do our parents not feel their children are safe walking to school in certain neighborhoods, and that's why they send them out? I think we should have this conversation, Senator Hand. I think it's a huge conversation. And it's a parent involvement conversation. And it's an economic conversation. And I'm not sure this is the place to have it, but we welcome that conversation. And we want to include in that conversation testing standards for all these schools as well and all of these children to make sure that they're at the same standard that all the public school kids are at. And some private schools are exceptional. And some, let's find out how exceptional they are. I happen to think that all the kids in Minnesota, whether they're homeschooled, because we have a wonderful online home, I'm very familiar with it. I know people that use it. I think we're blessed in this state. We're really blessed. And we're leaders in what can happen in your state in a positive way for kids, whether it be parent involvement, the legislature investing in education. We're very blessed in this state. But I think this is not the place to have that very huge conversation. But we would be happy to join you in that conversation in a very positive way.
Thank you. I think we'll wrap up with one comment from Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to share with you something that I have been really looking at. From the very beginning, I thought that this is an issue that I really need to pay attention to. Parent involvement, of course, is something that what Senator Hand stated is absolutely important to all of us. As I read some of the information that is available to us as to how legislatures have really approached this issue and how we take into account what we know about parent involvement to really look at how do we implement policy to encourage those kind of efforts. I find that there is a lot of controversy around this issue. One, because there is inconsistency in the definition of parent involvement, that what some people perceive to be effective parent involvement, other people think that is not enough. So really coming up with a consistent effort that really is supported by different constituency groups seem to be very difficult. The other one that there is right now some controversy about transfer, the perception that people have that schools are in tough situations tend to blame parents for the academic achievement of children, and this is particularly true for low-income children of color. So that the tendency today and the focus on transferring the responsibility of parents to schools is unfair. And so, therefore, there is really some reluctance among parents and certain groups to accept the notion that we somehow have to legislate parent involvement. There is also an issue that has been some people are writing about, which is that there is a tendency in certain communities to look at their parent participation in the disability movement, and that people see that somehow children of color and parents of children of color need to be actively involved and somehow use that model, because there is a tendency to see children of color as a group that has similarities with children with disabilities. And so the tendency is to look at asking parents to be as involved as a parent with a child with a disability. And the final one is that I think Senator Salzman spoke about this, which is how do we view today this issue of parent participation? Is it assigning parent the responsibility for the outcomes or empowering parents to make sure that schools meet the needs of children? And apparently, as I read more and more, these issues create really a difficulty for us because, you know, the lack of consistency, this blaming effort that takes place, because more and more we are defunding programs that help, you know, parents, after-school programs, programs for children with disabilities. Early childhood education is not funded. So as we have a system that is less able to meet the needs of the current family, we tend to blame parents for that deficit. And I know we're running out of time, but I would like to hear a brief comment from you as to what do you think is your perception? Do you agree with that? Do you think that we are moving into a situation where we have a system that is no longer accountable and responsible, and then we are trying to find out who do we blame for that inefficiency?
Well, I think, you know, and I've been thinking about what Senator Salzman asked us about, and I think there is an expectation here. Many of you, I hate to refer to Oprah Winfrey's show, but several months ago, she talked about a group in California that it was a very large high school. I think there was about 2,700 kids in it, of varying cultures. And the black educators in the building noticed that the black students out of all the cultures were scoring the lowest. And these were teachers, and they just decided that they needed to do something about this personally as teachers. And they asked the principal if they could bring all the kids into all the black children into the auditorium and nobody else. And the black teachers and the black kids sat down. And they had this huge discussion on why are you doing so poorly? And they decided as educators, because these kids came from very low income, drug addicted parents, you know, just the whole panacea of what goes on in the inner city sometimes today. And they established a group of teachers that had expectations for these kids. Now they worked with them one-on-one, they counseled them, but they took over the parent involvement role, basically because the parents weren't involved. They expected their test scores to raise about 6 points. Their test scores rose 53 points on whatever test they were giving. I can't remember what it was. It proved to them that, and then the parents started getting involved because these kids just were off the scale, but it was called expectation. And they talked a great deal about expectations. And I think sometimes if we can't be involved as parents, when I was raising my 5 kids, they had an expectation. They were to go to school every morning. They were to finish their work, and they were to be responsible for certain things. Now, granted, my husband was an educator, and I was, for the most part, a stay-at-home mother and a PTA person. But there was still, I'm not going to do your homework. I am not going to load your backpack. And I am not going to see that you have your lunch in it. If you miss lunch one day, that's your problem. You were expected to learn. And so maybe the whole education community, we need to talk about expectations too, because we don't need to spoon feed these kids with a parent involvement bill, but we do expect parents to have an expectation for their students. And I know in talking to other educators that teach in high income, say Wayzata, for instance, my son-in-law came from Virginia, high income high school, came to Richfield, taught for 3 years, went to Wayzata, and said the expectation was so much higher that the kids were never late for class. If it's just a matter of expectation, that's a pretty easy thing for any parent to do. And I think parents of any culture do have expectations for their children. And we need to have that conversation. And we need to have it with the legislature. If we're going to have a parent involvement bill, we all need to weigh in on it.
I think, first of all, we have to stop pointing fingers at it's this group or that. You know, it's the parents, it's the administration, it's the teachers, it's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, that's what happens when you know, money gets tight and things get difficult. We start blaming. What we need to do is put that aside. We need to look at the research that's in front of us, and we need to make a commitment that we're going to make this work. We're going to make our public schools work. We are going to, like I spoke earlier, there's that assumption often with parents that they don't want to be involved. That's what I meant with we have to clearly articulate to our parents, not to say you must be at such and such a school at such and such a time, but rather to communicate with them that, you know what, your son is struggling. His first test scores are not doing well. 2 weeks into class, here are some skills that you may help you help them learn. My children, I have all boys. They were late emergent readers, and one thing that always surprised me is that I was never ever given tools on how to tutor their reading. Rather, I was told that I need to just sit close to them. And there were assumptions made that I didn't have books in my home. I'm an English teacher. I have more books than I know what to do with. But there are assumptions made. We have to put those assumptions away. We have to clearly articulate our purpose with our parents. We have to provide an environment so that parents, whatever their cultural background, whatever their economic background, that we can provide that dialogue, that we can begin to make it work. We spoke, Senator Erickson Ropes, we spoke earlier, and we, before the beginning of the testimony, and one of the things that I believe so strongly in PTA is that PTA provides tools that help implementing community, parents, teachers, administrations to come together and figure out how each individual situation, how do we make it work with our kids? How do we make it work with our kids? Because each environment is situation is going to be different. And we need to empower and we need to support that there are going to be differences in each school district, in each parent situation, et cetera, et cetera. But it is, again, building coalitions, not to stereotype, not to compartmentalize, but to look at each individual as an individual situation.
Thank you. Any other comments? I think this does bring us right back to that little critical area in the middle between parent involvement or parent empowerment, like Senator Saltzman is saying, and then requiring a certain number of parental tasks to occur, and can we do that or should we do that? So we'll just continue to struggle with those sorts of things. Senator Saltzman.
Here. So just a clarification, Madam Chair. I feel that if we're going to attack this problem, if people bring forward questions, if we look at that as we're trying to blame a group, we're never going to have an open discussion. Mm-hmm. And I went to a charter school, and I know Senator Han is on the board of that chair, and I was so impressed because the teachers talked about high expectations, that these children will not fail. And if you talk about maybe a different role for parents or a different role for teachers, I hope that then we're not seen as, well, she's trying to blame parents. He's trying to blame teachers. They're trying to blame the schools. That word blame, I get really nervous about because it cuts off anyone ever talking outside the box. So I hope that my comments is that I'm not trying to blame parents. It's just, what is a meaningful role? And that we should have higher expectations for kids and maybe higher expectations for parents and legislators. And it's not just the legislature. We need to be partners with the governor as well. So I'll just add that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us today. I think we'll move ahead to Dr. Samuel Myers. And welcome for being with us today. He's from the Roy Wilkins Center. Okay. And I understand that Dr. Myers is going to be presenting with Dr. Susan McElroy today, and she's the Associate Professor of Economics and Education Policy from the University of Texas at Dallas. So welcome to our committee. I appreciate very much you being here today.
Good morning. I'm joined today with Dr. Susan McElroy, who is a professor of economics at the University of Texas at Dallas. And we've collaborated extensively on the analysis of racial gaps in test scores. And so I'm going to ask Dr. McElroy to begin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure and an honor to participate in the hearings today on the achievement gap in education. As both a scholar and researcher in the area of education policy, it's not an opportunity that we often have to speak to persons involved in legislation regarding education. So thank you so much for the invitation. I'll first give just a brief overview of what we plan to cover today, and if it's all right with everyone, we're just going to go back and forth a little bit during our presentation, but we are giving one presentation together. I'm going to make a few introductory remarks first about measuring the achievement gap, and without going into too much technical detail about how we can measure the achievement gap, we just want to make clear the ways in which we are measuring the achievement gap, the way we approach it in our research, and to clarify that that's not the only way, that there are a number of ways that we could think about measuring the achievement gap. Then my colleague and co-author, Dr. Myers, will talk about the time trend of racial gaps in Minnesota test scores, focusing specifically on eighth grade scores from the time period 1996 through 2005, math and reading scores. Then I'll talk about comparing Minnesota to national average data from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, emphasizing the recently released data from that study. Then we'll move on to, does school poverty cause racial gaps in test scores, which Dr. Meyer will talk about. And finally, I'll speak just a few moments on policy instruments to narrow the achievement gap. So let me first make a general statement, that is that scores on standardized tests are clearly not the only way that we can measure educational achievement. But test scores are taken as a measure of educational achievement, both in a policy standpoint, from a policy perspective, as well as in a research framework. So we take test scores as an indicator of educational achievement and use them as a way to compare students from different groups in the context of the achievement gap. But we do want to point out that there are other indicators of educational achievement, including, but not limited to, grades in school, also dropout rates and high school graduation rates. So all of these measures are indicators that we could use to compare, for example, one school district to another or one state to another. I should also point out that regardless of the measure that you might use to compare states to one another or school districts to one another within a state, absolutely any educational outcome measure that you could use is not, none of them are perfect. So they all have some advantages and disadvantages. They all have flaws. I could have listed SAT scores there also. SAT scores, again, would be a way that one might compare, and often people use them to compare one state against the other, despite the recommendation from the College Board that people not do that. Okay? Today we're going to talk about two sources of test score data. So in other words, having said that, there are a number of educational indicators that we could use to measure and assess achievement, and that test scores are only one of those. Having said that, I want to make clear the two kinds of data that we're using today to talk about the achievement gap in Minnesota in particular. My colleague, Dr. Myers, will talk about, review some data from Minnesota state test, and I will talk about scores from a national assessment. And we, in order to make any kind of comparisons, one state to another, whether it's Minnesota to the national average or Minnesota to other states, we have to have some test that's given across states, preferably in every state, that would allow us to make those kinds of comparisons and the best assessment that we have, again, though it's not perfect, the best that we have is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. So I'll talk about the scores from that assessment. Dr. Myers?
I want to underscore the notion that understanding racial and ethnic gaps in achievement and in test scores requires us to step a moment back from the issue that was addressed in the previous testimony about what contributes to improvements in test scores. So, for example, something like parental involvement is well known to have an overall positive effect in improving test scores. But my understanding is that the purpose of this hearing is to talk about reducing the achievement gap. Therefore, if an indicator has the effect of improving test scores on one group more so than on another group, you need to be very cautious in concluding that that particular factor will reduce the gap. There are two things I want to do very quickly. The first is I want to summarize what we know about the gap in Minnesota. It's made more difficult by a number of changes in the tests and the way we report the tests. So I have retroactively computed what the test scores are from 1996 and 2005 because I ran out of time. I actually had to skip a few years. So I'm looking at 2005 in comparison to 2099, 98, 97, 96. I have a report where I do an extensive analysis of the test scores between 96 and 2000. I update this to 2005 using the same metric. The metric is the percent correct on the mathematics and on the reading exam. More recently, the state has adjusted those metrics to account for degrees of difficulty. But at least through 2005, every student who was born before, who was in eighth grade before a particular year, was required to take this basic standard exam. The fact that we're not requiring this in future years does not distract from the point I'm about to make. The point I want to make, and I hope Star Tribune is here today, is that whatever they were doing in Minnesota between 1996 and 2005, designed to reduce the test score gap between African Americans' whites, between American Indians' whites, between Latinos' whites, in a moment I will talk about Asian whites, whatever we were doing, yielded some positive results. So now is the time to start patting ourselves on the back that we were doing something right. That's the first point I want to make. I'd like to demonstrate that the gap, as measured by the percentage difference in percent correct on the mathematics and reading exams, narrowed during this 10-year period. And we should be proud of what we were doing. Now, I know some of the things that happened. Many of the things that happened were incremental, not big, major transformations, but incremental things. People at the school level, principals, teachers, people struggled to find something that worked, and they found some small things that worked, and there were some small gains. So that's the first point I want to make. And then I will turn it back over to Dr. McElroy, and she gave me an opportunity to make a second point. And the second point is that one of the big causal explanations, one of the factors that people believe instinctively in Minnesota is the cause of the racial gap is poverty. And I would like to try to address that issue because at a previous panel that I was not able to attend, one of my colleagues at the University of Minnesota tried to make the point that the cause of the racial gap was concentration of poverty. And I just want to just be very clear that the statistical evidence does not support that conclusion. So now I would like to try to tell you what happened between 1996 and, 2000. And I'm going to look at some of these graphs. Let's talk about, you might not be able to see this too much. This is the percentage gap between American Indians and whites in the mathematics basic standard test scores, uncorrected for degrees of difficulty, but measuring the percent correct for eighth graders. Go back to American Indians. So there was a 15% difference in the percent correct on the math, exam in about 1997, and that gap widened between 97 and 99. It narrowed somewhat between 99 and 2000, and continued to narrow. until 2005. So it means that the percentage gap in 2005 is considerably smaller than it was at the late 1990s. So for American Indians, the gap narrowed. Next, for Asians, well, the math gap didn't narrow consistently for Asians. So this is the one group where I find, A, there's a smaller percentage gap. B, that small percentage gap didn't narrow that much, and there's some erratic variations. And much of that has to do with what economists call heterogeneity, the fact that this is one group called Asian that represents a lot of different people. And so we've actually broken this down separately for Hmong, for Vietnamese, for Chinese, for Koreans, Japanese. And what you find is that Chinese, Japanese, Korean Americans have a higher average percent correct than whites. Hmong, Vietnamese, Cambodians have a lower, but you put those two groups together and there's a lot of variation. Let's move on to the Hispanic white gap. After a period during the late 1990s where there was a widening gap in the math test scores, after about 98, there was a continuing narrowing. To give you a sense of what these numbers mean, zero means there's no gap. Minus 15 means that there's a 15% difference between the percent correct on the math exam for Hispanic and the percent correct for math exam for whites. So that means the farther down you go on that graph, the bigger the gap. Okay, the farther you go up, the smaller the gap. And so what you see is that between 1989 and 2005, there is a narrowing of the gap in the math test scores. Now, I should say that for African Americans, the percentage gap is the next one. It's huge. The percentage gap between African Americans and whites on the mathematics exam is larger than the percentage gap for any other racial groups with respect to whites. Moreover, for most of the 1990s, that percentage gap was around 25 to 30%. However, good news, and somebody should begin to broadcast this good news. By 2005, that percentage gap had narrowed to about 18%, so that means that that's good news. Now, 18% is still huge in comparison to the 5% gap between Asians and whites, but it's still something that was happening, something that was an improvement, something was going on in the schools, and I believe that the teachers and the principals and the parents and the students themselves should be congratulated for these improvements. Those are the math gaps. And the reading gaps, the gap, the percentage gap between American Indians and whites narrowed from around 16% and 1996 to around 10% in 2005. For Asian Americans versus whites, they got, next slide, narrowed from about 10% in 1996 to about 5% in 2005. And Hispanics, whites, the gap narrowed from around 17% in 1996 to about 11% in 2005. And for African Americans, the gap narrowed from more than 25% to about 14%. In fact, there was a bigger narrowing of the gap among African Americans in the reading test scores than in the math test scores. Now, I have a paper that's published in the Journal of Negro Education that kind of takes this same data and decomposes it and does some analysis to try to understand what's going on. And one of the pieces of information that we convey is that there is some competition in our schools between narrowing of the math gap and narrowing of the reading gap. on one hand, you have to be able to read in order to be able to do the math. But on the other hand, there are some substantive skills involved in the math component. Moreover, math teachers are pretty hard to find nowadays, and they're a little more expensive. And the ability to get the reading test scores up through some of the conventional techniques that we investigated in our research might not be the same as those for reducing the math gap. Let me just give you an example. One of the factors we found, a small factor, what seems almost trivial and inconsequential, one of the factors we found was attendance policy. Factors that, things that can get kids in school. And so Minneapolis Public Schools, listening to the same presentation at one point, and they asked the question, what can we do with respect to attendance policies that would improve test scores? And my response was, rather than have the bus go around once, let the bus go around twice. I mean, if somebody's late for the bus, I mean, that means they missed school. An alternative is you've had 5 buses going around your neighborhood. You don't know which one is your bus. Let the bus stop around the second time. And so transportation policy is one vehicle for trying to get incremental increases in attendance. Now, why does attendance matter? The reason why attendance matter is that for the math scores, the way we teach math, okay, so this test score includes fractions, percents, and ratios, as well as special relations and, you know, some other factors. But it turns out that the portion of the curriculum that deals with percents is a portion that, if you miss, disadvantages you when you get to ratios and division. And, you know, it's really all the same thing. But it turns out that the way they're teaching it is that missing one module in the math class places you at a disadvantage. So that's the role of absences. That's the role of attendance. Okay, that's one factor. So that means that transportation policies and things that you can do in order to try to increase attendance rates have the marginal effect, the minor but incremental effect of improving test scores, and it really did improve test scores. Fact number one is that in the state of Minnesota, the attendance rates of African Americans were lower than the attendance rate of whites. Fact number two, the marginal effect of increasing attendance rate is relatively high, particularly in math. So anything that can be done to get those attendance rates up will tend to narrow the test score gap. Okay, but that's another factor, it's mobility. In our data set, we had some kids who had been in 7 different schools in 1 year. I mean, it's unconscionable. How is it possible for somebody to attend 7 different schools in 1 year? Okay, these are kind of the outliers, which is driving some of the statistical analysis. But mobility factors have kind of a, like a policy context. In some instances, schools were using movements from school to school as a substitute for dealing with behavioral problems. So it means that you have people who have been suspended, you have people who have been expelled, you have people who have been... And this whole issue of if there's a behavioral problem, you should deal with that behavioral problem right in the school, because there is a disadvantage that's evidence in the test scores of having large amounts of changes from school to school. I do understand there are a lot of social and demographic factors that go in the background of mobility, but one of the big payoffs we found in our analysis of increasing test scores is to try to reduce mobility rates. Now, having said this, it's just kind of like the facts. The fact is that test scores narrow in this period. The fact is that the school superintendents, the teachers, the principals, and so forth were listening to the same presentation you're listening to 5 years ago. And what did they do? They did things. And some of the things that they did were things in the classroom. I've heard some negative comments about the fact they were teaching to the test. But they were teaching to the test, and the substantive things that were required by the legislature in order to be able to graduate are things that people ought to know. And if you've looked at the exam, one of the questions in the 1999 exam is, how high is this table? Is the table 3 meters, is it 3 feet, or is it 3 inches? I mean, somebody should know the answer to that question. And so it seems to me that even though some of the teachers may have been teaching to the test, whatever was happening was paying off in this specific sense of reducing the racial gap and the ethnic gap in the test scores. Now let me turn this over to Dr. McElroy. Okay. Well, what are some of the lessons? One lesson is that narrowing the reading test scores was more successful than narrowing the math test scores. So it was a lot more work. But they both narrow with respect to African Americans, American Indians, and Hispanics. The Asian test scores, I understand, are reflective of a more heterogeneous population. So it wasn't, the math test scores didn't narrow considerably, but the reading test scores did. Okay, so that's one lesson we learned. Another lesson we learned is that there's some competition between improvements in the reading test scores and improvements in the math test scores, and that whatever was happening over this period between 1996 and 2000 2005 seems to be obscured by the fact that we've had two major changes. One, we've gotten rid of the basic standard test score in the eighth grade, and we replaced it with another test score that everybody after 2005 will have to take. And the second is that there's been norming and scaling, and rather than reporting the data the way it was always reported, percent correct, is now being reported as a standardized test score. There are ways to recompute the old test scores in order to provide, you know, a metric. But the fact is that there were improvements, significant improvements, in the reduction in the racial and ethnic gaps. And I think that this committee, if any committee, ought to be lauding and ought to be celebrating the fact that people worked hard in order to try to narrow some of those gaps. And we should be very proud of the fact that we're on the right track.
Thank you. I'm going to come back. I'm going to switch gears just a little now to talk about the National Assessment of Educational Progress. This national scale study was first administered in 1992. This is a U.S. Department of Education study, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with it. The 2007 scores were recently released. The subjects assessed include reading and math. For grade 4, reading and mathematics. For grade 8, reading, mathematics, and writing. And for grade 12, writing. Each student who takes the test is given items in only one subject, and students can spend up to 50 minutes on the assessment. So what can we say about Minnesota in particular? The assessment was held in this state during the period from January 22nd through March 2nd of 2007. Over 3,000 schools were included in the initial sample for the state. A few schools were eliminated on the following, based on the following characteristics. Schools that were closed were eliminated. Special programs that do not qualify as regular schools were also eliminated. And finally, schools in which grade levels had changed over time were eliminated. After those schools were taken out of the sample, which was a total of 10 schools out of that 300, 290 schools remained, and those were the ones who participated in the assessment. In terms of the number of students, approximately 12,500 students participated in the assessment in 2007. So if you want to know a little bit more specifically about what does the assessment actually cover, let me speak to that for a moment. For the grade 4 reading assessment, the content areas include and are two: reading for literacy experience and reading to gain information. For the grade reading assessment, the content areas are the same first two: reading for literacy experience, and reading to gain information. And then the third content area at the level of grade 8 is reading to perform a task. The NAEP reading scale ranges from 0 to 500. The NAEP is often referred to as the nation's report card, so you may have seen that in some reports that you've read. Content areas of grade 4 mathematics assessment include the following: number properties and operations, measurement, geometry, data analysis, and probability, and finally, algebra. The same content areas apply to the grade 8 mathematics assessment, so I didn't repeat the bullet points there, because they're the same. The NAEP mathematics scale ranges from 0 to 500, which is the same numerical scale as the reading assessment. So if you want to know the answer to the following question, how did Minnesota scores on the NAEP, the nation's report card, compare to the national average? The answer is really very straightforward. And that is, for grade 4 reading and math, I didn't try to report the Minnesota averages and the national averages for every single test, but focused on the reading and math scores, the answer is really simple, and that is, as you probably are aware, the Minnesota averages, these are the scale scores, are above the national average in every one of these, for every one of these areas, for grade 4 reading and math, as well as for grade 8 reading and math. And I report here the actual figures for the averages. So in some sense, from the perspective of educational achievement in the state overall, the last slide is really good news, that Minnesota is above the national average. When we get to this slide and we want to focus specifically on the achievement gap, and I'm sorry that you can't see all the text at the top, but it says Minnesota's achievement gap persists. And here we take a simple measure of the achievement gap as the percent difference in average scale scores. Okay, and so in the same way that Dr. Myers calculated a percentage difference in the average test scores of African American or Hispanic students as compared to white students, I've done the same here with the NAEP scores. So for the black-white gap in reading was 16.7%. So that means that the average for black students was about 17% lower than the average score for white students. For the Hispanics in grade 4 reading, 15% gap. And for grade 8 reading, for black students, the gap was about 11%, and the same for Hispanic students. Moving to math, for grade 4, the black-white gap is at 13.5%, slightly larger than the gap for Hispanic students, the gap between Hispanic and white students being at about 10%. Finally, for grade 8 mathematics, the black-white gap was 14%, and the Hispanic-white gap was 10%. Now, what I don't report in this PowerPoint presentation keeping it not too long and having some time for questions, I don't report the average scale scores by race. But I do have that data available. If anyone would like it, I'm happy to make it available to you. But these percent differences were calculated based on those average scale scores that are broken down by race. Before I go to policy instruments, I'm just going to give Dr. Myers an opportunity to speak briefly about the role of poverty.
What Dr. McElroy didn't say was that those percentage gaps in Minnesota are smaller than the average for the United States. So that means that we need to be very clear. We may have the highest incarceration rate or one of the highest incarceration rates in the state. We may have one of the highest racial disproportionality rates in children in the child welfare system. But when you talk about the racial gaps in test scores, we have some of the smallest racial gaps. Moreover, when you move away from NAEP and you move away from the basic standard test scores, but you look at things like the math scores on the SAT exam, Minnesota has one of the highest African-American math scores. You may say, well, only people who take the SAT exam in Minnesota, people plan to go to Ivy League college, but they really are black. They really are black people. Minnesota took the exam. And, you know, if a recruiter from the Coast Guard Academy is trying to find some black high achievers, who are they come to? They're going to come to Minnesota. So I'm trying to give a sense of a positive spin on this negative evidence. Okay. Yes, it's true there's a gap. Yes, it's true that that gap represents some significant failures. But on the other hand, the gap is narrowed, and on the other hand, it's not as bad as it is some other places in the United States. Now, let's talk about the cause of the gap. Okay, the list is long, but at the top of the list of why is there a racial gap in test scores, not just in Minnesota, but in the United States. At the top of the list is the concept that poverty is the cause of the racial gap in test scores. And this is a particularly attractive explanation in Minnesota. Because if you say poverty is the cause of test scores, it's the cause of the racial gap in test scores, it kind of absolves us of the culpability of the race component. So it's not about race. It's about poverty. Okay, poverty sub A. It is school poverty that is the cause of the racial gap in test scores. Poverty sub B. It is individual poverty. I mean, whether or not it's school poverty or individual poverty, it's both a concept that seems to be easy to embrace. It does remove us a bit from policy unless you're able to provide an explanation for why is there a concentration of poverty. And if you have an explanation that says the concentration of poverty is related to housing policies, is related to zoning, is related to, you know, historic segregation, then you've got a good policy instrument in order to eliminate the racial gap in test scores. One tiny problem, and that is using the National Education Longitudinal Survey data, using National Longitudinal Survey youth data for 97 or for 72, or using the Minnesota Basic Standard data from 1996 to 2000. One little problem. None of these data sets reveal consistently after appropriate econometric procedures are undertaken that school poverty has any measurable effect on racial gaps in test scores. Now, yes, it's true, scores are lower in poorer schools. But recall what I said at the outset. What we're interested in is not just achievement, but racial gaps in achievement. And it turns out that some of the high-scoring African-Americans in the state go to some of the poorest schools in the state. Central High School, for example, had more national merit finalists than Blake or Blake had. So you have to be real careful when you try to figure out that it's poverty or school poverty that's the cause of the racial gap. Moreover, if you go out to the suburbs to, you know, Edina or to Hopkins and so forth, and you look at the African-American students who come from middle class or, I mean, their incomes are comparable to the incomes of individuals who are in those schools. Well, those schools are high-income schools, regardless of what the income of the individual students happen to be. Their test scores are comparable to test scores of individuals in St. Paul and Minneapolis. So the test of the hypothesis that poverty is the cause of the racial gaps in test scores is kind of refuted by both descriptive, you know, statistics and more detailed econometric, you know, analysis. Now, we did do a detailed analysis of the Minnesota Basic Standard Exam between 1996 and 2000. And we did what is called a decomposition analysis, a regression technique that attempts to partition the racial gap between the portions that can be explained and the portion that can't be explained. The explained factors had to do individual characteristics, school characteristics, family background characteristics. This was a merger of the MARS data set and the basic standard data set. So it means that we have individuals on information on individual family background, on individuals, as well as on the school characteristics. What we don't have in that data set, we don't have any information on the teacher. Okay, so, but controlling for the factors of individual characteristics, school characteristics, and family background characteristics, you also test the hypothesis that the racial composition of the school and the poverty composition of the school explains the racial gap in the test score. Now, remember, I'm not asking, does poverty or racial segregation have an effect on the test score? Rather, I'm asking, does poverty or does racial segregation explain the racial gap in test score? In order for it to explain the racial gap in test score, there has to be some sort of differential effect of a segregated school or a poor school and a white kid and a non-white kid. And the answer is that there is very little statistical evidence to support the view that school poverty is the cause of racial gaps in test scores. Now, individual poverty, yes. We do find some measurable effect of individual poverty. But you have poor kids. There's a woman who just testified who's from Hutchinson. A poor kid who lives in Hutchinson is going to have, you know, lower test scores just as a poor kid in St. Paul, Minneapolis will have. So there are individual factors, but what is poverty measuring? By the way, poverty in this data set is measured by free reduced price lunch. So what is it measuring? Is it measuring something about the family? Is it measuring something about the individual's ability to learn? And the answer is that it's a confounded, you know, factor. Okay, so the number one hypothesis for why there's a racial gap in test scores is that it's school poverty. It's poverty. And the answer is that the statistical evidence doesn't support that. Now, a number two hypothesis that's frequently offered that it's impossible to test using this particular data set is it has to do with teachers. It has to do with the expectations teachers offer. It has to do with the racial mismatch between the teachers and the students. Okay. I can't test this hypothesis, but I would love if this committee gave me authorization to match the teacher files with the Morris data and with the basic test score data. I realize that this data happens to be personnel data and is protected by Privacy Act, but take their names off, take their zip codes off, take all the identifying information off, and just let me know what their age, race, gender, certifications, years of education, and then let me test the hypothesis that it really does matter. Because I don't know right now, even though when I was interviewing some faculty members at Washburn High School, I met a physics professor who talked about the good old days when people did their homework, where people came prepared, and now we have these people walking in with their hats on side, back, and their pants falling down, and they're not doing the physics homework. And I'm trying to understand, is the fact that the test scores are going down related to the fact that people have their hats on backwards and their pants are falling down, or does it have to do with this kind of perception on the part of the physics teacher that the other has now come in and it's more difficult to teach them? Now, they did say, many of the teachers I spoke to did say, it is more difficult to teach physics to those types. What term did they use? Those people. I'm trying to figure out exactly what you mean by those people. But it's kind of a nuance here that you pick up in anecdotes that teachers perceive that the students before them can't learn, won't learn, and so the level of expectation is lower, and therefore the kind of impact that they have on their lives might be different. But guess what? That's an anecdote. That's not science. That's not, you know, a statistical result. And I would love to be able to test that hypothesis rigorously so that we could either accept it or reject it. And this is the one place in Minnesota you keep hearing people talk about racism among teachers or lower expectations among teachers. This is one place where we got to really look at it, grab it, and if it turns out to be false, then announce it that it's false. If it turns out to be true, then maybe we need to do a little sensitivity training and retraining and so forth. Okay, so that's another, you know, hypothesis. Another important hypothesis is parental involvement. And my good colleagues from the PTI have had a lot to say about parental involvement. The most important thing that came out of the conversation with you about parental involvement was Senator Tory's raised comment that what exactly do you mean by parental involvement? Because of different ways of measuring it, different ways of incorporating in analysis. And it turns out that the National Education Longitudinal Survey and the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth both incorporate the empowerment notion that Senator Sussman mentioned and the engagement notion. The empowerment notion means parents feel that they can walk in and they can speak to the teacher, they can email the teachers, they can call the teachers, as well as the engagement measure that they help their children with their homework, they volunteer, you know, in the school and so forth. So there are about 8 or 10 measures in the data sets. We've looked at those measures, and guess what? Parental involvement improves white kids' test scores. It really does. But for reasons that I think that Dr. McElroy might want to talk about, why does parental vote for improved white kids' test scores? And there's a statistical debate about what's going on. However, parental involvement has wide variance. In other words, I mean, that I find a statistical effect, but the statistical effect's not statistically significant. It has a wide variance of effect on children of color in different populations, partly because the children of color represent a wide variance of abilities and family forms. So parental involvement, what specifically do you mean by parental involvement when a kid isn't living with their parents? Where a kid is in foster care, where a kid's in living with their grandparents and so forth. And so Dr. McGorry has a whole lot of research on the issue of family structure and the impacts on test scores. So what is the jury, what does the jury have to say about parental involvement? I think the most important thing is that I am never going to be quoted as saying that I'm opposed to parental involvement. I'm in favor of it. And we should do it. But if the purpose of this committee is to think about reducing racial and ethnic gaps in parental involvement, you need to be aware of the statistical evidence. And the statistical evidence seems to show that the parental involvement effect is huge with respect to whites, wide variance with respect to other racial and ethnic groups. And therefore, the solution to the problem of narrowing racial gaps in test scores isn't going to be simply in parental involvement as it is conventionally measured in data sets that I've examined. Now I'll turn this over to Professor McElroy.
Thank you, Dr. Myers. In conclusion, we're going to spend just a few minutes talking about policy instruments to narrow the achievement gap. And let me be very clear on the policy instrument section that we in no way intend to advocate any one policy instrument over another. We don't intend to present any statistical evidence, program evaluation data that would suggest one policy instrument ought to be selected over another. What we really want to do is encourage discussion and debate and to identify and emphasize that there are, in fact, policy instruments that are available that have the possibility and the potential to narrow the achievement gap. In that spirit, let me go through three four, actually, that we can talk about. And I'm going to spend the most time on the piece that has to do with involving families and communities. Policy instruments to narrow the achievement gap cover a wide range, and one of those would be tutoring programs for students with low scores or students in schools with low average scores. So the idea here is that for whatever reason, certain students are scoring lower on tests, and by having special tutoring programs available, if the tutoring programs are effective, then one would expect over time that those students would then score higher on the test. The second policy instrument is improving teacher quality through professional development. There's a lot more that we could say about improving teacher quality, and as you know, this has been one of the hallmarks of the No Child Left Behind policy. Now, let me also point out that professional development is not the only way to improve teacher quality, but it's one way, and I wanted to identify something specific. But you could also talk about the quality of teachers who are hired. You could also talk about retention of qualified and successful teachers. And you could also talk about the opportunity cost for teachers in fields like science and math. I mean, this is something that as economists, we talk and think a lot about opportunity cost. That is the value of the next best alternative. I mean, that's the way I teach it in Principles of Microeconomics, you know. Freshman students coming in, taking their first economics course, if there's any one point that I want them, concept I want them to understand at the end of the course, it's the concept of opportunity cost, which is anytime you make a decision to do something, you're giving up something, okay? And so if we better understood what opportunity cost means in the context of teachers making choices about employment, we might better, we might come up with some innovative ways to address the shortage of science and math teachers in particular. Because those are the teachers that tend to have the higher opportunity cost of teaching, because they're the ones who are giving up more in the sense that they have better opportunities, higher paying. Let me be clear, higher paying opportunities in the paid labor market outside of teaching. Okay. The third policy instrument, empowering school leaders, principals, and other administrators. And we don't specifically say empowering them to do what, right? But in some sense, what we're talking about is giving them opportunities to, for example, strengthen programs that show some promise, okay, to have the opportunity to experiment with programs that seem to have an impact on students' achievements, and particularly programs that seem to have an impact on the racial achievement gap in test scores. All right. The policy instrument I'm going to spend the most time talking about, partly in the spirit of connecting with what the earlier presenters talked about, is involving families and communities in children's schooling. And I use the language families and communities on purpose, and instead of parental involvement. Okay. It's important that we are aware of the wide variety of family and living arrangements. Why? Because that variety of family and living arrangements has important implications for children's educational achievement. Let me say a little bit about the family structure and living arrangements in particular. One thing that we know from census data, which in the spirit of keeping this in a reasonable amount of time, a time length, we didn't include in this presentation, but again, we'd be happy to make available to you, is that family structure and living arrangements of children in the United States have changed dramatically over the past few decades. I can't emphasize enough things like, for example, the increase in single parent families, the smaller percentage of all families that are made up of married couple families being the mother, the father, and the child or children in the home, okay, in the same household. The shift from married couple families, two parent families, to single parent families has important implications for children's educational development and achievement. And let me also be clear that as researchers, we don't have the answer to exactly how it matters, but we do know that it does matter, okay? In other words, it's not a simple story to say that we can expect children who grow up in single parent families not to do as well in school. Right? And I want to emphasize the point that the story is not simple at all like that, and it's especially not simple when you move into the African American and Hispanic communities. Okay. So we begin from the simple statement of these enormous changes over time that have taken place in family structure and living arrangements. One example of these dramatic changes is the increase in grandparents as primary caregivers. And why is this important? It's important not only because we can look at the census data to reveal that more and more children are living with their grandparents, and their grandparents are primary caregivers. We've always had multi-generational families in the United States. So in other words, there has always been a segment of children in the school-age population who live in the same household with their grandparents. What is different now is that more and more of those children live with their grandparents, that those grandparents are their primary caregivers. And furthermore, and this is important too, that in-between generation, the parents of those children is more and more often not in the household. Okay, so in other words, what we were talking about before was the child, the parents' generation, at least one parent of that generation, and then the grandparents all in the same household. Now what we have that's becoming more and more common is the children with the grandparents and that middle generation is not in the household. Okay, let me speak to a couple of reasons why that middle generation is often not in the household when the grandparents are primary caregivers. The reason I want to go into detail about this is it has important implications for what we are calling parental involvement, okay? One reason that grandparents often become primary caregivers many of these reasons have to do with issues that people don't want to talk about. And those are problems such as drug abuse among that parent generation, in other words, the parents of the children who are in school, okay, the drug abuse problems, and incarceration, okay? In other words, it's the reasons why parents, grandparents often become primary caregivers that will help us understand why grandparents may not be as involved in the children as participatory in the schools or as involved in their children's education as we might think that they ought to be, or that they don't respond to calls from parents. They don't necessarily respond to calls from the schools for parental involvement. Now, I need to give credit to one of my doctoral students at the University of Texas at Dallas, who completed her doctoral dissertation last May, defended her dissertation last May, who did her research on grandparents as primary caregivers in the Dallas Independent School District. Much of what I know about this is based on research that she did that involved surveys and personal interactions with grandparents. Okay, so that's important. Another important issue, and I'm speaking specifically to grandparents as primary caregivers, is that grandparents often are not the legal guardians of the children. Again, for a variety of reasons, and because they are not the legal guardians of the children, they may be hesitant to contact the schools or to respond to calls for parental involvement. Okay. Now, I just used grandparents as primary caregivers as one example of these major changes in family structure because they're really important. Okay. Schools have not changed as quickly as the society has changed in terms of these family structure and living arrangements. And so you have issues like registration. There may be no evening time for registration, for example. Simple things like that that seem to be out of step with the reality of people's lives and living arrangements as well as their work schedules. Okay. So at the end of the day, what can we say? We could say that we need more and better evidence on what education reforms actually impact the achievement gap, that we have these policy instruments at our disposal, and we may be able to, if we think creatively, come up with some more that haven't been tried yet, okay? But we really need to know more about which ones actually work, which ones work for which students, okay, and which ones are likely to have the greatest impact on the achievement gap. Thank you very much for your attention, and we'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. We covered a lot of ground, so I think we do have some questions. I do want to get back to one thing that Dr. Myers mentioned earlier. I thought that Minnesota had one of the highest achievement gaps in the nation, and you said, in fact, we have a very small achievement gap. Could you clarify that, please?
We're reporting the 2007 results from NAEP, and so what year are you referring to?
The year is where we are. We didn't know, Dr. Myers. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. We didn't know that you were bringing already an analysis of 2007, which I really, really appreciate because you did this for us. And I understood that you didn't have the time, but this is a quite revealing piece of information for us.
Yeah, I think here at the Capitol, we're generally, our mindset is that Minnesota has one of the largest achievement gaps in the nation. And if we've closed that in 2007, that's great news. If we're closing it or making progress on it, that would be great. Then the other question to follow up on that is, again, our past understanding of the achievement gap in Minnesota has been that it's a large gap, but if you can look at it in a good way, it's because the top performing students are doing so well that when you consider the lower achieving students, that creates the gap, rather than on a national level that we're just our test scores are all really down low. That we have a large achievement gap because some of our students are doing so very well. Would you say that's still the case, or how are we to understand that now?
Give him some time to read it.
You take it.
I think there are two separate issues. One issue is how do we rank with respect to other parts of the country? And the second issue is how do you explain the improvement, or how do you interpret the improvement in the measurement of the BSRE standard test? The ranking with respect to the country is based on the national NAEP.
Yeah.
How do you pronounce it? National Assessment of Education and Progress, you know, test scores. What I'm referring to in the discourse about improvement is on our test score, the basic standard test scores. This is the percent correct. And the percent correct, that the gap between blacks and whites, American Indians, whites, Hispanics and whites now, between 1996 and 2000, between 2000 and 2005. It is a reflection, in my view, of small things that happened in Minnesota. One way of discounting that narrowing the gap is that the test score for math was about 84% correct for whites, and it was about 59% correct for blacks in 1996. And it was about 82% for whites in 2005, and it was about 62% for blacks in 2005. So the gap narrowed. But if pass rate is 70% or 70%, then blacks are still failing. So why do we care about the fact that gap narrowed from 25% to 15%, there was still a huge share of blacks are failing? And my response to that question is that we probably should be worrying more about improvement as opposed to the absolute test score, because it's eighth grade. So my response to your question is that we have undervalued the increase in the relative standing of minority kids by not celebrating that, by not acknowledging the fact that there were improvements. We have also discounted the roles of individuals like principals and teachers who helped to marshal those improvements. And it's kind of discouraging to keep hearing over and over again about how poorly these kids are doing, when in fact the gap is narrowing and there's an improvement. Now, you may be correct about the relative standing, because there are two sets of scores from NAEP. There's the weighted score, the adjusted score, and the unadjusted score. And I think I'll have to wait until after this hearing in order to give you a more thorough analysis on that.
Okay. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for your interesting presentation. It was very revealing, and as Senator Erickson Ropes mentioned, some of these things, information is new to us, and we're very anxious to learn more about it and see what kind of improvement we've made, and hopefully we can begin to celebrate more aggressively the things that you're talking about. And I also wanted to say to Dr. Myers that I, for one, would certainly support a way to help you to do the research that you indicated you wanted to do to try to look at the effects of teaching on these achievement issues. And maybe there's a way to do it with the help of the Department of Education here in Minnesota. So maybe that's something that we as a committee can help encourage. But what I wanted to do is ask kind of the same question I asked the previous testifiers with respect to some of the school choice policies that have been implemented across the country. And there has been some research, Paul Peterson and Carolyn Hoxby and I think Eric Honoshek, among others, have talked about the, with respect to achievement gaps and performance of African-American students, and there seems to be a strong correlation between those voucher and choice programs yielding very statistically significant improvement. And there's even been some discussion that it may be related to the fact that many of the voucher schools that are chosen are parochial or religious schools, and that there may be some element of that into this result. And I'm just wondering if in the research that you have done, have you looked at this? It's not on your policy instrument list, and I'm wondering if that's because it's uncertain in your mind that there is something to be recommended here, or if there's another reason why that would not be something that we should look at.
I think you're going to get two different answers, you know, from us. I've use Peterson's evaluation of the voucher program in New York City as a teaching tool. What you might recall from the Brookings study is that the biggest gains occurred among Hispanic kids and not among African-American kids. So it means that the vouchers actually worked, but the Hispanics were more likely to go to Catholic schools, and the Catholic schools had smaller classes and they had uniforms and they had more disciplines. And a larger share of the Hispanics were Catholic to begin with, and many of them wanted to go to the Catholic schools. And so there's kind of a selection bias effect. And what Peterson does in his Brookings report is he tries to correct for that selection bias. One of the things you might remember is that the biggest gains were in the fourth grade, and many of those gains disappeared after the eighth grade. So you have to be real careful about what is the voucher effect as opposed to what is the selection effect. So there are some parents who want their kids to go to private schools, and if you give them money, these are people already involved in their kids' lives. They are very, very committed to the notion of a parochial school education. First of all, none of the schools in the New York experiment were, elite, private schools, because the voucher was only $2,000. Okay, but it was a good experiment. It was a good randomizer. It was good science. It's good, tests. But there's a dissipating effect on the test scores. The longer you're away from the entry to the program, the smaller the marginal effect happens to be. The most sustained effects were with respect to Hispanics and not with respect to African American people. Having said that, what is it that you're trying to do? What are vouchers attempting to do? And we're using word school choice, but what we're really doing is we're trying to take the public money and to redistribute it into the hands of the individual buyer so that the buyer can get the best match to the portfolio of educational goods that they want. What are you trying to do? And the answer is that, A, private schools have some really innovative portfolios. So that means that you're more likely to get more than one language. You can get Chinese, you can get Latin, you can get, and they have night sports, and they have, swimming pools and a variety of different, amenities, things that make the educational experiences a rewarding experience. However, is the goal to move the small number of kids who could possibly get into the private schools to those private schools, or is the goal, or should the goal be to incorporate some of these innovative techniques into the public schools? Okay, I have to talk about swimming. Okay, do you realize that Minnesota has the second highest drowning rate in the United States among African Americans between the ages of 9 and 14? Some people say, well, that's because we have a lot of lakes. But they're not drowning in lakes. They're drowning in public swimming pools. Why is that swimming kind of a metaphor for these racial gaps in test scores? And the answer is the fact that you think on the surface that the problem would be the legacy of discrimination. I'm from Baltimore. Baltimore has segregated pools. So there's a black pool, there's a white pool. But Minneapolis has a lot of swimming pools. The state of Minnesota, through some of its educational reforms, ended up putting in middle school swimming pools as opposed to high schools. So it means you really have a relatively high per capita number of swimming pools in the state. So how can you explain the racial gaps in drowning in a state that has a relatively liberal attitude toward investment in pools? So you can find swimming pools in inner city areas. You can find swimming pools in rural areas. So is the solution just the access to the pools? Or is the solution, how do we incorporate the knowledge and information and the skills that we know exist in some, because swimming is kind of like a country club sport, right? And so that the biggest teams, the fastest teams in the state, well, I was about to say that, but that's not really true. I mean, I was about to say the biggest and fastest teams who went to private schools, but I think that Visitation and Breck won the girls' high school championship this year, and I don't think that they are, as fast as South, which is a public school. But elsewhere in the country, it's generally the case that the private schools have faster teams than the public schools. So what is it that makes what goes on in a private school something that you want to replicate in a public school? Is the solution to give a voucher to individuals to get them to the private schools, or the solution to try to find those innovations and incorporate them directly in the public schools? And my vote, if I had a vote, would be to try to figure out what are those innovative things that are going on in those private schools that can be replicated in the public schools. And one of those things happens to, I think, has to do with language. I think Chinese and Japanese. I mean, you know, you really have to start thinking about teaching the language that 1.4 billion people who speak Chinese. And how many public schools teach Chinese in Minnesota? Now, a lot of private schools teach Chinese. So that's an innovation. And so that's kind of why is Chinese a good thing to incorporate in public schools? Because the way you have to think, the reasoning ability, the technical skill that's involved in the grammar and in the match between the symbols and the wording is exactly the sort of thing that you want to try to teach in problem solving and analytical thinking. And so some of the things they do in private schools is that they link some of their quantitative analysis with their writing. Okay, so the science course and the English course integrate the same subject matter. So you're interested in wind power. And so you have people going down to Northfield to Carleton College and looking at the wind turbine. And you'll have the kids writing their reports, and the, you know, they have to do the outline, they'll have to do the footnotes and so forth. That's the integration of the science thinking with the, you know, the writing skills. Mm-hmm. That's something that they do at private schools. It's kind of hard to do that at public school, but that's the kind of the technique and tool. So although I'm not opposed to vouchers, I think the problem that we're trying to solve with vouchers is to try to transfer some of these advantages that exist in private schools into other populations. And the dilemma is the fact that, A, it probably won't have a large effect because there are not enough private schools to take account all the students who want to take advantage of private schools. And by the way, African-American families have uniformly expressed their support for vouchers. Okay, I mean, you know, the reason why they express their support for vouchers, poor African-American families have uniformly expressed their support for vouchers. And the reason why they express their support for vouchers is that they're so fed up with what's going on in inner city schools, they would say anything that works they'd like to take advantage of. But guess what? If every single African-American parent who expressed the interest in the voucher were to take advantage of a voucher, there would not be enough spaces. For full disclosure, I happen to be a board of trustees of Breck School. I mean, Breck School is talking about the fact that it can't accept all of its applicants. We're talking about the upper income, the high income families. There are far more applicants already than there are spaces. What would a voucher do? The voucher would just increase demand for a limited number of spaces. So that means, although I'm not an opponent to the voucher, I'm concerned about what the original problem was the voucher's trying to solve, and I think there are other creative ways of solving that problem. But that's just my view, and I guess Dr. McElroy might have a different view.
I guess that in terms of any kind of innovative, if we want to call it experimental in the sense of trying something new program, I think that we have to be aware of to go back to the issues with family structure and living arrangements, the reality of people's lives that I think we have to raise the question of who will be in a position to take advantage of these kinds of innovative programs. So, for example, if school choice requires compiling information about schools in order to make a decision about where your child might attend school, then certainly those parents who are able to devote the time to compiling and reviewing that kind of information wouldn't necessarily be more likely to choose a different school for their children or to take advantage of vouchers. But I think that we want to be aware of sort of that context, that not everyone has the same is in the same position to take advantage of those kinds of those kinds of opportunities. So I'm thinking about, for example, the difference between a family where there is both a mother and father in the home. The father has a high income position, and the mother is a stay at home mother. The mother is a stay at home mom. That's a very different kind of decision making, most likely, that's going to happen from, for example, a single parent family where the father or the mother is working two jobs. Okay, so I'm not coming out as against school choice or vouchers, but I'm saying we need to consider these kind of policy alternatives, any of these, in the light of what people's current reality, what the reality of their lives actually is. The other point that I think is important as far as whether it's school choice and vouchers or parental involvement, you know, is really the selection issue of who is going to participate or who is likely to participate. With parental involvement, for example, I actually believe that, and I've reviewed a lot of these studies on the effect of parental involvement on student achievement, and the conventional wisdom and our common sense, which, of course, at the end of the day, regardless of how many equations we estimate, how fancy our econometric models might be, we don't want to throw our common sense out the back door, right? We think our colleagues do sometimes, but we don't want to. And so I think that one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the research on parental involvement is not clear exactly what, when we talk about it as though we know parental involvement definitely has this unequivocally positive impact on student achievement. That doesn't really square with all the research that we have about parental involvement. Not that parental involvement is ever negative, but the question is not whether parental involvement has a positive impact on student achievement, okay, but what the process is. In other words, if we find that parental involvement impacts student achievement in a positive way, why is that the case? And I would argue that part of what we're dealing with here is a simple selection bias effect. In other words, that those parents who tend to be more involved in their children's education are not a random sample of all parents. What does that mean? What that means is that those parents who tend to be more involved in their children's education have certain characteristics. Certain things are true about those parents that would also impact their children's education. For example, they may be parents who themselves have higher levels of education. They may be parents who, because of their own personal values and their own life experience, value education in ways that may be different from how other parents value education. So in other words, anytime we see an impact like a positive impact on parental involvement on student achievement, not just parental involvement, but any other factor that has been shown to have a positive, or for that matter, a negative impact on student achievement statistically, we really need to understand what that process is. That's why we spend the time constructing and estimating these models of educational achievement to try to really understand what is the process. If parental involvement does in fact have a positive impact on student achievement, why is that the case? Because from a policy standpoint, it's really important that we know whether it's the parental involvement itself that matters or whether it's those characteristics of the parents that tend to be more involved that is really driving the impact of parental involvement on student achievement.
Well, I'll just make one comment to that, and I think it links back to something I wanted to say about the PTA's presentation. And you'll notice here that they have moved from saying parental involvement so much to family-school partnerships. And I do tend to say parental involvement a lot because that's been sort of the lingo of the last decade as parent groups have tried to convince the education community that their voice is as valuable at the table as the teachers and as the administrators, that parental involvement does bring some advantages for student achievement. And when I was on connected with the National PTA just a few years ago, even we were saying parental involvement at the same time, we certainly understood the family structure was much broader than a sort of a traditional two-family parental structure. So I'm glad to see that they have, in fact, moved to the family involvement, because your points about who makes up families today is absolutely critical in understanding how family involvement or significant adult in a child's life, whether it's their guardian or a next-door neighbor, really is powerful. So thank you for bringing that up. Senator Torres-Ray.
I am going to try to be very brief because I know everybody wants to take this opportunity to ask you a question. First of all, I just wanted to thank you, Dr. Myers, and thank you, Dr. McElroy, for being here. And the committee knows, and I hope the audience also need to know, that we have very few African-American scholars that have really done extensive statistical analysis in this area. Very, very few. And you are two of them. So it really is a privilege to have you here today. And I wish we could have more time, and I hope that we are able to organize a conference because your presentation is quite complex, and I think it is unfair to really make statements at a policy level based on a very brief presentation. So I hope we have an opportunity to come back. But I would like to ask you a question about an idea that we are pursuing, and I am personally pursuing right now. It is my understanding that based on the research that has been published, that a lot of the efforts that Dr. Myers talked about, that unfortunately we don't have good evidence of, are efforts that have been developed at the local level, meaning that these are individualized efforts that really, in many times, cannot be replicated. So do you believe that it is fair to think today that in order to propose policy for the state of Minnesota, we need to open the door for the school districts to present their own strategy to deal with the achievement gap so that they can develop something that is individualized and based on their community needs?
Did you say individual schools or school districts?
School districts.
School districts.
In other words, I am thinking that the more I hear presentations, the more I understand or learn that it is very difficult to have a statewide, perhaps we can use some of your recommendations to do kind of an overall recommendation in terms of statewide policy, but is your opinion that we should continue to encourage development of specific policies that are individualized at the district level to address this issue? Because communities are not the same. When we talk about Minneapolis, we're not talking about Moorhead. We have a very different districts dealing with different issues in the state of Minnesota.
Well, it certainly makes sense to me that districts would have some leeway, that districts would have some leeway in designing and implementing programs to address the achievement gap. I think one issue that would need to be thought about, though, is that even within a school district, and especially if we're talking about the large urban school districts in this country, there's some important differences even within school districts. So I think that we have to balance some sort of standardization against empowering and allowing both individual schools, you know, at the level of a campus and school districts to bring to the table what they actually know. Because if whether you're talking about principals or whether you're talking about classroom teachers, they all have an experience and knowledge that they would like to bring to the table to offer their input and suggestions about what ought to be done to address the achievement gap. Now, it's not going to be practical to implement, to pass and implement every suggestion that's made by every classroom teacher in school district. So that I think there would have to be some kind of guidelines, you know, put in place and some sort of process that would make sense to allow those or to provide a forum for those and a process for those suggestions to be brought forth and possibly implemented.
I appreciate your prefacing your remarks by saying that the policy discussion is being conducted without the statistical analysis. So I have not done a policy simulation, which I'm capable of doing, in order to evaluate the strategy of decentralizing the racial gap policies. Okay, that requires somebody taking, or somebody, I guess, maybe works at the Department of Education, just doing a calculation of what would happen if you had individualized school district level efforts as opposed to a statewide effort. Mm-hmm. But having said that, having pointed out that I haven't done the statistical analysis, I'd like to try to sketch out something from another kind of analysis that you're familiar with that should alert you to why decentralization might work. We did analysis of the child protective services in counties, and we looked at the racial disproportionality and child neglect and involvement with the child protective services for the whole state. And then we looked at the three counties that represented the largest share of children of color in the state. So you had something like 87 so counties, and three counties basically represented the bulk of children of color. But it turns out that the racial disproportionality in those three counties, which is Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Dakota County, and the racial disproportionality in those three counties was actually smaller than it was in the rest of the state. That there's an illusion of disproportionality that is created by the physical mismatch between the location of children of color and the calculations that you're computing. The whites in the state are disproportionately outside of those three counties, and the minorities are disproportionately in those three counties, and you're comparing kind of apples and oranges in some respects. Mm-hmm. So a policy that's designed to reduce racial disproportionality in the state misrepresents itself because each one of the counties is evolving in a slightly different way. That doesn't mean that there's no disproportionality, you know, out in Stearns County or in, St. Louis County. There is disproportionality, but the nature of it and the character of it and the process which has gotten that way might be different from what's in Hennepin County and Ramsey County. So without doing the calculation, at least it seems like a plausible hypothesis that decentralization would work. I know that's not your job. I mean, it's easier for a senator to come up with something, a state policy, as opposed to something that is district policy. But let me propose something that solves that problem. Is that you don't really have that much power over the local school districts, but there's one thing that you might be willing to do, or at least consider, and I'm sure somebody can do a policy simulation to figure out whether or not it'll have much of an effect, and that is to provide incentives to the individual districts where the payoff occurs if there is a continued reduction in the racial disproportionality in test scores in their district over, let's say, 3 years or 5 years. So it can't just be 1 year, but over a period of years. Now, that doesn't say you have to do it, but what it says is that if you do it, there's the benefit that you'll receive. So it's kind of like a bonus, and it's like a public good because it's in the state's best interest to see that there is innovative, ground-level efforts in order to reduce the racial gap. The problem is that it's probably less likely that one policy from the whole state is likely to be effective. Rather, what's likely to happen is that there'll be some districts that will do a real good job, and there are some districts that won't do such a great job for reasons that are kind of related to what we've been talking about, the long list of different things, some of which are incremental. And so I would recommend that, A, that somebody do the policy simulation first in order to see whether or not this conjecture it makes sense. And since many of you are familiar with the value associated with doing kind of a projection or forecast, before you vote on something, before you actually decide you want to do this, it would take
a non-trivial amount of time, you know, maybe 3 months in order to do this kind of calculation, but it's worth doing to calculate what are the costs, what are the benefits associated with the decentralized policy that's specifically focused on reducing racial gaps in test scores. That means that there's the choice on the part of the districts to implement different strategies or propose innovations, and that the reward will be some funding, some additional funding, a pot of money that's allocated by the state and is divided up based on the success and the ability of reducing gaps. Now, that's kind of the way I think as a policy analyst and as a quantitative analyst, but I'm not sure if that's being responsive to your question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rummel and then Senator Saltzman will have to wrap it up here quickly. I know other people have meetings following this one as well. Oh, and Senator Carlson, too. So, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to echo the sentiments of other senators that it is a pleasure to have both of you here tonight or this afternoon or morning, whatever it is, and that your presentation has certainly opened a lot of questions and ideas in my mind. Earlier, in the very beginning of your presentation, you suggested that we use test scores to measure. There are many ways to measure student achievement, test scores being some of them, and that test scores often are used to compare schools and states. I'm wondering if there are measurements of student achievement that actually, instead of comparing, that actually promote student success, that there's a feedback system that improves that achievement. If, after all, that is what we are after. How do we improve student achievement? What kind of measurements are most helpful in getting there?
Well, obviously, the original purpose of tests was to provide feedback to teachers. So that means that the final exam is not the most important test. The most important test was the test that was given after the first lesson, where you find out what do they know, what don't they know, and then the one after that first lesson, how much did they acquire? I mean, the testing is designed to provide feedback. That was the original purpose of the test. And so many of these tests are regarded as instruments for learning, but also instruments for teacher and administrators to improve and adjust the curriculum. Now, that's harder to do in a public school. It's easier to do in a private school in the sense that the adjustment of the curriculum in order to meet the needs of the kids that are in this classroom right now is something that we sometimes don't provide teachers with enough flexibility, you know, to do. So I want to echo two things. One is that we ought to be re-emphasizing tests as a feedback mechanism to assist an improvement. But the second is that it might require something on your part to think about how we can implement that, because if you have inflexibility on the part of changing the curriculum in the middle of the year, I mean, I did analysis of textbooks and parental involvement and poverty in Minneapolis public schools, and one of the things that we were looking at is how math teachers like to Xerox things rather than use textbooks so that they can, A, avoid the problem of lost textbooks because of some statewide, or maybe it's a citywide policy with respect to textbooks. Okay, so there was some reimbursement problem or something. If you lose the book, you have to pay. I don't remember all the details, but the gist of it was that teachers were disinclined to let students take textbooks home. Mm-hmm. Right? How can you do homework if you can't take textbooks home? But a policy was implemented at a higher level that kind of required schools to be responsible for the lost textbooks, and too many people were losing textbooks. So there was a group of teachers that got really innovative, and they said, let's Xerox it and hand it out. Two things they're doing that are illegal. One is that they're violating copyright laws. Two, they're using state or city money inappropriately Xeroxing stuff. And so people went to Kinko's and they Xeroxed it themselves, or they purchased their own Xerox machines, or they ran it through their fax machine. Got it. That level of inflexibility thwarts the efforts to make the adjustments that a feedback mechanism through an exam would provide. And so that's something that you as a statewide lawmaker can be, you know, instrumental in changing.
I guess that my answer to your question would be, and it's a very good question, and I have to admit just offhand, I don't have a really good answer to it. But I think that what I would say is tests themselves don't encourage academic achievement. Tests are designed to be an evaluation mechanism, a way for, as Dr. Meyer said, the teacher to see what skills the students have, what the students have mastered. But tests themselves aren't designed to encourage academic achievement. They're a way to see, and let me be clear to say that it isn't that tests themselves don't serve a role, but the role is to give us a measurement of academic achievement. So it's the process of what's happening in the school, what's happening in the classroom, that's going to determine, and the whole administrative structure as well is going to determine whether or not students learn, if that makes any sense. But I don't see the tests themselves as encouraging academic achievement, although they do play an important role as an evaluation and a feedback mechanism.
My point was really, are there other measures besides tests that will help us?
I think the answer to that is absolutely, but I think we have to think creatively about what those are, and I think we have to take a long, hard look and really study some programs that have been, some innovative programs that have really encouraged students to think differently about education. I mean, I come from a family of educators, and so my father, not being the educator, when he's in a conversation with my mother, who's a retired elementary school teacher, and my sister, who's a high school chemistry and physics teacher, he sometimes finds his way out of the conversation because it seems that most every weekend we need to try to solve the educational problems in this country through our conversation. But the reason I mention that is because I think that there are some programs out there that make a difference, and I think the ones that really make a difference are the ones that change the way students think about learning and the attitude that students have towards school. I mean, that's part of what's going on now. I teach undergraduate and graduate students at the university level, but what I don't see is a thirst for learning. I don't see that desire to just want to learn as much as you can, the way that we had it in college and the way that we had it in high school. I might disagree a bit with
Dr. McElroy here, in the sense that I think that we live in a society where tests are valued. And I think that we need to be teaching people how to take tests, how to do well on tests. But I also believe that tests have been proven to be efficient ways of giving feedback to teachers. There are inefficient ways, like, for example, continued one-on-one observation, I mean, kind of a British-type education of tutoring and so forth, but that's an extremely expensive way in order to get the feedback. And so, number one, I think that because tests are valued in our society, I mean, there's so many things I can do in my life. There's so many things you can do with your life. I can't change this issue. Right now, tests are regarded as valuable. They're used in businesses. They're used in, you know, the military. I mean, you know, it's really, and you've got 1,000 people. You've got to sort them somehow. Okay, so this is our society. We value tests. So people have to figure out how to take the tests. But second of all, the information has to be more valuable to the people teaching the class. And that's one weakness that we have right now, in the sense that the test is frequently used primarily in order to label the kid about whether or not the kid has learned the material, and not to give some sort of assessment of the teacher's effectiveness.
Thank you. Senator
Salzman?
Yes. To that point, Madam Chair, if I may ask Dr. Myers and Dr. McElroy, are you familiar with the problem-solving model or response to intervention? I will take it that maybe it's a new term.
I'm not.
Okay. So then you have teed this up, Senator Rummel, in that we did pass legislation this last year in Minnesota to talk about progressive monitoring and how tests can be teachers' friends, tests that teachers like to give because they provide input for instruction. And the whole RTI model, response intervention, is progressive monitoring of kids so that we can identify right away is an intervention, and an intervention is not meant, it's a teaching strategy. And we're trying to do this. We started the RTI Center in here in Minnesota. All of the introductory sessions have been completely filled up by teachers and principals who want to use this model because it's really looking at kids trying to intervene earlier. So that goes to my original question was about teacher quality. I have a report in front of me. What education schools aren't teaching about reading and what elementary teachers aren't learning? And what we're doing in another work group in early intervention and literacy is that some of the models that are most effective, young teachers don't know. We are trying to retrain teachers. So my question is that when we look at improving teacher quality, what is the role of our higher education institutions? Because what we're finding is that we're working on this in this committee, and it's probably going to be a delicate subject, is some of the models that work are not being incorporated into our teaching colleges. And how do we promote them to be players in this as well? Because as we spoke earlier, you know, we're not trying to place blame. It's just that everybody's got to look at their roles. And how can we do that? Because I see the tutoring programs for students and the whole RTI model is what we're talking about is that why always pull these kids out? Let's start doing some of these effective things within our classrooms. So I just want to throw that out as role for higher ed. You both come for higher ed. How can we involve our teacher colleges?
Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm at the University of Minnesota, and University of Minnesota has one of the larger, you know, schools of education in the state. And there's been some criticism of our school of education, despite the fact that our president is a former dean of that school, of being somewhat lagging in its success in producing teachers who are the right match to the schools. But that begs the question. I mean, is it because of the curriculum at the College of Education, or is it because of the students who make choices to pursue education degrees? Now, this is tricky. I know it's a slippery slope, and I know I'm going to regret saying what I'm about to say. But we probably need to look beyond schools of education in order to hire our math and science teachers. We probably should think about rethink some of the accreditation. I mean, right now you have a series of rules and regulations about what you need to do in order to be certified in order to teach. But there's some really great engineers around this state. Some of them are reaching retirement age. They have inventions. They pretty much know their stuff. But it's a struggle to get them into the classroom, you know, with the bureaucracy and so forth. I know I'm going to regret saying this, but I really do feel that we have to push the boundaries here, you know, go a little more expansively to rethink what we mean by a teacher. There are some incredibly bright graduates of schools like, you know, Carleton, McAllister, and so forth, who can't qualify to teach because they don't have the, you know, whatever it's called that you require in order to teach in the state. But they're really smart, and they're really innovative, and they're really fun in the classroom. I mean, wow, what can we do in order to get those individuals? Anyway, that's my two cents on the matter.
So you know about the Teach for America program? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. Because I know they're trying to expand here in Minnesota, and they are recruiting some of our brightest college students who, you know, have not typically gone into education, but, you know, are very committed. So just a thought to that comment. So,
Senator Saltzman, I think you bring up a point that we've talked about, I know, in the healthcare committee, and that is that as we struggle with some of the challenges, whether it's in education or whether it's in healthcare, there is not one silver bullet, mm-hmm. but we're typically silver buckshot. Yes. And so lots of different perspectives and different things need to happen and change and be improved.
Senator Erickson-Robes, if I could just add a couple of points to my testimony. I neglected to mention the name of the doctoral student whose research I cited. Her name is Dr. Andrea Hilburn. She is, at the time, her title was Assistant Superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District.
and she completed her PhD in public affairs at UT Dallas. So I just wanted to mention her name because I had talked about her research and not said her name. I also wanted to point out that these are not recommendations. The policy instruments that we listed are possible. They're policy instruments that exist, and they're ways in which policy might possibly impact the achievement gap. But they're not ones that we selected as the ones that we would recommend. Yeah, we would really have to do some more research to be in a position to make a statement such as that.
Okay, thank you.
And finally, on this slide, if you got the handout for the PowerPoints, it shouldn't say source National Center for Education Statistics. I just forgot to take that out. This is ours. This is our thinking here on the last slide. So.
Okay,
thank you so much.
I think we'll wrap up with Senator Carlson's question or comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Drs. Myers and McElroy. And not only did I find this very interesting, but also quite entertaining, too. I'm one of those engineers that is retired, and I was looking for a low-paying job, so I came to the legislature. But I have another question. I learned a word here, the heterogeneity you mentioned when you talked about the combination of people from different demographic groups together with the Asian group. What about the new Americans, new Black Americans, versus the people that have born here and are several generations here? You know, obviously there are some language problems that perhaps new Americans have that, and they may not be in the test demographic yet, but they do enter the test demographic. Did you decouple those results, and how do they look?
I did break out the analysis of the 96 to 2000 data by Somali and West African versus Caribbean-born Blacks. And, you know, it's incredible that the native-born Blacks and the foreign-born Blacks converge in their self-scores. Even though we conducted separate hearings and, you know, presentations to each of the different ethnic communities. And many of the Somali participants said, well, at least we have an excuse. You guys don't have an excuse. I mean, by which they were saying that their kids didn't start until they were 9 years old, whereas the African Americans started when they were 5 or 6 years old. But when you look at the statistical analysis, you know, it's not a lot of difference between a foreign-born Black and a native-born Black, which is scary in the sense that what is it that could explain how two people with very, very different cultural backgrounds, very different values associated with education, differences in native languages, differences in socioeconomic, you know, wherewithal in order to be able to extract from the school system, you know, resources, how can you explain how those two groups kind of converge with respect to their test scores? And my answer is that in some schools, a Black is Black. It's not like, you know, you're kind of reconceptualizing we've got Blacks who are migrated from Chicago versus Blacks who are from, you know, a village, and rather, these are dark-skinned kids. And a disproportionate share of the teachers may have as much difficulty relating to somebody who doesn't speak English, who comes from a rural background in, you know, East Africa, as they have relating somebody from inner city from East Chicago. So the heterogeneity is less a problem in the analysis of Black/African-American/African than it is with respect to Asian. With respect to Asian, it's real. It has absolutely no relationship at all between the Chinese-American, the Korean-American, and the Japanese-American sample, and the Hmong, Vietnamese, and Cambodian sample. There's almost like two different groups, completely different groups, if by various measures of statistical, you know, association and so forth. So the heterogeneity problem is a problem with that's significant with respect to Asian, is minor with respect to Blacks. Hispanics, it's there.
the Cubans, the Puerto Ricans scored different than the Mexican Americans, and I don't remember what the Colombians did, but I mean it's really not as big a problem in the Hispanic population as the Asian population. So to be specific, the heterogeneity problem is something that needs to be really addressed when we talk about, quote, the Asian test scores. There's nothing called the Asian test scores. What you have is you've got three pools of Asians in this data set. One pool of Asians are Hmong, Vietnamese, Cambodian, Laos, and then another pool of Asians are Japanese, Chinese, and Korean. And then another group are called Asian in the United States who don't even call themselves Asians in Asia. And these are Indians, Pakistanis, and so forth. So and the data sets really don't. Many, if you go to Rochester, for example, you see in the public schools a large concentration of people from Southeast Asia, from you know India, from Pakistan, and so forth. But they're sons and daughters of professors at Mayo Clinic. So that's the real heterogeneity problem, and I think that we should be careful when we discuss the statistical results when it relates to the Asian population.
Thank you very much for clarifying that. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Well, seeing none, I'll thank you again very much for coming and doing your presentation to us, and we'll maybe be getting back to you in the future with some other questions. Thank you so very much, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.